We begin our journey into mankind's imperial past with the Akkadian Empire, the first the world bore witness to. Established near the end of the 3rd millennium BC by the legendary Sargon of Akkad, it stretched across the regions of Mesopotamia, Anatolia, and the Levant, claiming much of present-day Iraq and even parts of Iran, Syria, Kuwait, Jordan, and Turkey. Akkad's rise and fall marks one of the most riveting chapters of the story of Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization. It was a time of great change when a peripheral warrior society led by a charismatic ruler brought to heel perhaps the most advanced civilization on the face of the earth. That may sound like a familiar story, one that brings to mind Alexander the Great, Attila the Hun, and what seems like countless other figures. But Sargon of Akkad was the first of them all. And since there can be no firm understanding of either his or Akkad's origins without at least a passing familiarity with the broader Mesopotamian civilization that they belonged to, we will devote the entirety of this episode to what came before them. In doing so, we will have the context necessary to make sense of the Akkadians and their successors. Because as certainly as day follows night, so too does one empire follow another. It was the ancient Greeks who gave us the name Mesopotamia, translating to the land between rivers. However, the etymological roots of the name run deeper, with the Greeks most likely borrowing from Aramaic and Akkadian in turn. The rivers referred to in the name are, of course, the world-famous Tigris and Euphrates, which empty into the Persian Gulf. Fed by the snow-capped Taurus and Zagros Mountains, these relentless, silt-carrying rivers were violent, subjecting the surrounding lands to devastating four-story-high floods every spring when the snows would melt. It was only in the second half of the 4th millennium BC, as temperatures rose and precipitation levels fell, that the sister rivers of Mesopotamia were calmed, becoming less prone to outbursts of watery wrath. The effect was felt most keenly in the silt-enriched southern Mesopotamian floodplains, enabling human communities sustained by fishing and farming to form alongside these two rivers. To combat the lack of rainfall, these communities undertook elaborate irrigation projects. They dug canals, built dikes, and cultivated new tracts of farmland, which led to burgeoning populations and the development of so-called hydraulic civilizations. According to the traditional narrative, the scope and scale of these projects necessitated the centralization of power and social stratification, thereby setting into motion a process that began with the city, proceeded with the city-state, and organically culminated in kingdoms and empires. However, this narrative has recently come under fire by historians who have pointed to more egalitarian communities administered by town councils, which were perfectly capable of creating irrigation systems without the supervision of an overlord. Such examples raise the question, is there anything inevitable in the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a small elite? A question that lingers when we turn our attention to Uruk, the earliest of Sumeria's city-states. Known as Erech in the Bible and Warka in Arabic, the name Uruk comes from Akkadian, a slightly modified version of the original Sumerian. And despite the name's unfortunate resemblance to the Uruk-hai of Middle-earth, it is the name that persists to this day, both for the city-state and the corresponding period in Mesopotamian history. Unlike Tolkien's orcs, the people living at Uruk seem to have been a pretty sophisticated and clever bunch, having invented not just the first city-state, but also the first system of writing, with their artistic and bureaucratic conventions providing a template for the Akkadians, Assyrians, and Babylonians alike. A Sumerian poem from 1800 BC, much later, commemorates the supposed birth of writing. Because the messenger's mouth was heavy and he couldn't repeat the message, the lord of Kulaba, a district in Uruk, patted some clay and put words on it, like a tablet. Until then, there had been no putting words on clay. Interestingly, because of a clay tablet dating back to this time bearing a pictographic representation of a wheeled wagon, we also know that the people at Uruk made use of, if not invented, that other hallmark of civilization, the wheel, which was probably used for pottery first. But whether or not they invented it, and regardless of whether its first uses were reserved to pottery, there is an important lesson here. In those days, history was not written by the victors. The victors were those who wrote down anything at all. Other cities like Eridu came before Uruk, but because the people of Uruk wrote things down, we know much more about it, and can therefore attribute more to its remarkable civilization. A civilization that lasted an enormous span of time, for the better part of the 4th millennium BC. At its height, Uruk is thought to have reached an urban population of 40,000, with that number roughly doubling when one also takes into account the cities and colonies under its rule. Besides its population, so huge for its time, and its control of surrounding territories, Uruk further distinguished itself from past cities through its monumentality. Its sandal-clad workers, nourished on water skins, beer, and bread, used new tools like hammers, chisels, braces, saws, and nails, supplied by wheeled wagons and river-faring boats, to build structures that reached for the heavens, structures that were meant to last, made not merely of mud brick, like past cities, but a combination of limestone, clay, bitumen, and a primitive concrete mix composed of gypsum and baked bricks. Perhaps the best example is the White Temple, built on top of the Anu Ziggurat, that is, a terrace dedicated to Anu, the king of the Mesopotamian pantheon of gods. At this point, you may be wondering, who was overseeing all of this activity? Who ruled Uruk? The answer is hotly debated to this day. The first historians studying this period, ambiguously referred to as Assyriologists, would have us believe that it was a class of temple priests, and that Uruk is the foremost example of the transition from primitive democracy to temple rule taking place in the broader Mesopotamian world. What we know for certain is that the city's temples, like the legendary White Temple, were indispensable for the smooth functioning of society. It almost goes without saying that these towering structures served both as ineffable expressions of power and sites of worship. But in addition to that, these temples were charitable institutions that provided widows, orphans, and other unfortunates with sustenance, not unlike medieval monasteries. Nor did their importance end there, as they also functioned as storehouses and workshops in which barley grain was stored, wool was produced, bread was leavened, wine was made, and beer was brewed. David Graeber and David Wengrow, two noted anthropologists writing on the subject, have even gone so far as to refer to these temples as the very first factories that we know of, with priests overseeing the allocation of tribute to the gods, a proto-corvée system of labor, distribution of raw materials, and even quality control of finished products using cylinder seals, which functioned as a form of stamp or signature. For record-keeping purposes, these same temple priests also pioneered the use of the earliest version of cuneiform, a system of writing that gets its name from the Latin cuneus, meaning wedge, due to the script's wedge-shaped characters. Such record keepers used styluses to carve characters representing goods and livestock into soft, wet clay tablets that were left to bake under the sun. Eventually, these two innovations, cylinder seals and proto-cuneiform, became linked together, as later seals would feature cuneiform characters. This allowed for a more economical way of disseminating information, better suited to the uses of a record keeper concerned with tallying up crop yields or confirming the receipt of a new shipment. Yet another innovation was called the bula, a clay sphere used as a token to represent different goods. Clever as they were, though, the temple priests at Uruk would never have guessed that this pictographic script, developed for the purpose of mere bookkeeping, would form the basis for the world's earliest literature, poetry, and legal codes, opening the door to a centralization of power the likes of which the people at Uruk had not known. For, although temple priests controlled so many aspects of commodity production, we now have evidence to suggest that public building projects and the dispensation of justice were both still in the hands of assemblies, composed of the sons and daughters of Uruk, as they would call themselves, with women being able to take part in the proceedings, hold land in their own right, rise in temple administrations, and even assume control of the household under certain circumstances. This is in marked contrast to the more advanced, yet demographically restricted democracy that would develop in 6th century BC Athens. As we reach the end of the Uruk period, which spelled the end of temple rule, although not the end of the city-state of Uruk itself, one may speculate that it is the lack of centralized authority and the consequent inability to mobilize manpower and resources on a sufficient scale that prevented Uruk from creating an empire of its own. Although it established colonies as far away as Syria and Iran, bringing back plunder and slaves, each foreign adventure would cost the people of Uruk more than it yielded. Trade was the more profitable course of action, and a perfectly viable response to addressing the growing needs of an urban population too big for its britches, not unlike the situation medieval Florence found itself in amid the fertile Arno Valley of Italy, with trade famously being its lucrative recourse. And much like Florence, Uruk, a region that lacked some of the critical resources it needed, like minerals, trees, and metals, eventually turned to trade as a means to enrich and embellish its civilization, not just feed it, sourcing copper, lead, silver, and gold from the Zagros Mountains, obsidian from Anatolia, cedar from Lebanon, and even lapis lazuli from distant Badakhshan in modern Afghanistan. But even though trade would proliferate in the centuries to come, it would by no means prevent conquest, colonization, and enslavement from becoming increasingly ubiquitous modes of advancing a city-state's interests. Uruk was no exception to these evolving, or devolving, rules of engagement, and its most famous resident, who had yet to come, would be a primary practitioner of this high-stakes game. That brings us to the start of the early dynastic period in the beginning of the 3rd millennium BC. The age of warrior kings and dynasties had finally come, with power shifting from temples to palaces, though still checked by temple administrations, citizen assemblies, and hostile neighbors. It is the age that roughly corresponds to that of the flood alluded to in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the most famous cuneiform text of all time, etched into a clay tablet now kept in the British Museum. You've probably heard about the Epic before, and you may be aware of the parallels to the flood myth of the Book of Genesis. However, unlike the God of the Old Testament, whose wrath was visited upon mankind for its corruption and sin, the Sumerian god Enlil, patron deity of wind, air, and storms, unleashes the same punishment on the earth simply because all the noise of these prospering cities was depriving him of rest. I guess even Mesopotamian gods needed their beauty sleep. The epic itself actually takes place hundreds of years after the flood, by which time priests and citizens alike paid homage to the Ensi, meaning Lord of the Plowland, or more simply, the Lugal, meaning Great Man. Titles both loosely interchangeable with prince or king. One such figure was Gilgamesh, king of Uruk, partly historical and partly mythical, his dealings with the gods immortalized in the form of a national epic, not unlike an Achilles, King Arthur, or Ragnar Lothbrok for the Mesopotamians. The epic represents the time of Gilgamesh as a time of war, with unguarded towns giving way to walled cities and temples giving way to palaces. In marked contrast to the preceding Uruk period, the archaeological record of the 3rd millennium BC bears this out, with traces of walls, palaces, elaborate burials, and royal inscriptions all beginning to appear in greater abundance. According to the epic, Gilgamesh is a catalyst for this process, exhorting the elders of Uruk to wage war against the northern civilization of Kish, ruled by a king of its own according to perhaps the second most important cuneiform text in our possession today, the Sumerian King List. It is Gilgamesh's inclusion in this list that gives credence to the claim that he was a real, historical figure. Regardless, there is something we can learn from the story of Gilgamesh. By its conclusion, Gilgamesh beholds the imposing fortifications that he had ordered to be erected around Uruk, and concludes that it is by such means, the raising of monumental works meant to withstand the test of time, that humans can aspire to immortality. This, after the gods had withheld the gift of corporeal immortality to Gilgamesh because of his inability to endure sleeplessness. Pretty hypocritical in light of the whole Enlil incident, if you ask me. But hypocrisy is the prerogative of gods, even with those gods who had once been men. In a poetic twist of fate, it would be Utnapishtim, the man who achieved immortality after playing the role of Noah and saving mankind from the flood sent down by Enlil, who would tell Gilgamesh that his quest was in vain. You will never find that life for which you are looking, spoke Utnapishtim. When the gods created man, they allotted to him death, but life they retained in their own keeping. As for you, Gilgamesh, fill your belly with good things. Day and night, night and day, dance and be merry, feast and rejoice. Let your clothes be fresh, bathe yourself in water, cherish the little child that holds your hand, and make your wife happy in your embrace. For this too is the lot of man. It is advice that Gilgamesh would take to heart, dying in his bed at a ripe old age after a glorious reign as Lugal of Uruk. To honor him after his death, it is said that his subjects temporarily diverted the course of the Euphrates to bury him in the riverbed. The same tale is recited for the deaths of Attila the Hun, Alaric the Goth, and Genghis Khan, exactly the type of company that Gilgamesh would keep, all of whom did in fact achieve immortality, in the sense that we still speak of them to this day. We now approach the end of the early dynastic period of Mesopotamia, roughly halfway through the 3rd millennium BC. By this time, in addition to more widely disseminated and developed versions of cuneiform and cylinder scrolls, we see the introduction of a lunisolar calendar for keeping track of harvests and religious festivals, the abacus, a hand-operated tool for calculation, and with it, a sexagesimal number system, which explains why we have 360 degrees in a circle, 60 seconds in a minute, and 60 minutes in an hour. It's an achievement that the Babylonians typically get credit for, when, in reality, it was a Sumerian inheritance. There were also important advances in art, increasingly more lavish, monumental, and commemorative of royal might and violence. One such example is a limestone monument which survives only in fragmented form, called the Stelae of the Vultures, which you can find today in the Louvre. This two-sided stelae, blending the real and the surreal, depicts the aftermath of a battle, the bodies of the dead trampled beneath the feet of a victorious army, as gods and vultures alike claim their due. It is the start of a long tradition of monumentalizing martial triumphs, which the Akkadians would emulate and the Assyrians would perfect. It celebrates the moment that the ascendant city-state of Lagash, under its king Ianatum, defeats its neighbor, Uma. In forcing Uma to become its tributary, and annexing nearly all of Sumer, including Uruk, Ur, and Larsa, Ianatum served as a Sargonic prototype, simultaneously inspiring dread in the hearts of men and fondness in the hearts of gods. To immortalize his many triumphs, Ianatum had a stone inscription made, which you can also find in the Louvre today. It read, Ianatum, the Ensi of Lagash, who was granted might by Enlil, who constantly is nourished by Ninhursag with her milk, whose name Ningirsu had pronounced, who was chosen by Nanshi in her heart, the son of Akurgal, the Ensi of Lagash, conquered the land of Elam, conquered Urua, conquered Uma, conquered Ur. At that time, he built a well made of baked bricks for Ningirsu in his wide temple courtyard. Ianatum's god is Shulutula. Then did Ningirsu love Ianatum. However, when Lugal-Zaggisi's reign as priest-king of Uma began, the predominance of Lagash was overturned. Through a winning combination of military prowess and marriage diplomacy, Lugal-Zaggisi wrested control of Sumeria from Lagash, conquered Kish, and established Uruk, the city of Gilgamesh, as his capital. It was at this point that Lugal-Zaggisi took the title Lugal-Kalama, or King of the Land. But Lugal-Zaggisi would pass none of these titles or lands to his children. Instead, this warrior king, the most successful since Ianatum, would be subdued by the hero of our story, Sargon of Akkad. Humiliatingly, after the walls of Uruk were torn down, the man formerly called Lugal-Kalama, King of the Land, would be fitted with a collar, like a dog or slave, and dragged to Enlil's temple in Nippur. After that, he passes from the pages of history, and we hear no more of him. Ultimately, Lugal-Zaggisi would be the last ethnically Sumerian king before the rise of Sargon. Ever since the age of Gilgamesh, warrior kings had begun to make their mark on Mesopotamia, especially in the less prosperous and more socially stratified north. a region more driven by the warrior ethos than the long-established city-states of the South, with their temple administrations and local assemblies. And now, for the first time in Mesopotamian history, the North would dominate the South, with Sargon of Akkad playing the role of a Philip of Macedon. In both cases, one can observe the rough, hardened warriors of the periphery bringing a sophisticated center of culture and commerce to heel, thereby opening the door to a reinvigorated civilization reaching unparalleled heights, even if it was at the cost of countless lives. Join me next time as we discuss the story of Sargon, the first Akkadian emperor, whose murky backstory, part fable and part history, rivals even that of Gilgamesh.